history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this incredible country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. On Veterans Day and every day, we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take these trips back in time, we learn so much. We're educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In a nation where the differences we carry are currently pretty evident, I hope that this Veterans Day weekend is an opportunity to remind us of one thing on which we should all be able to agree. Those men and women who have served in our armed forces deserve our recognition and our thanks. Maybe you should thank the veterans in your life by taking them to see Hacksaw Ridge, the new movie that tells the true story of Medal of Honor recipient Desmond Doss, who saved the lives of more than 75 men on Okinawa. That was the last major battle of World War II, but in the weeks ahead, you're going to be hearing a whole lot about the day that the war started for the U.S. We'll experience so many 75th anniversaries over the next couple of years, but December 7th will mark 75 years since more than 2,400 Americans were killed in Imperial Japan's surprise attack on the island of Oahu. Over the years, we've been privileged to hear from dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors on Hometown Heroes, and I have set up links for all of those full interviews for you at hometownheroesradio.com, but I wanted to share some relevant parts of some of their stories with you today to give you a little perspective on everything you're going to be seeing and hearing and reading about Pearl Harbor in the weeks ahead. I thought I'd give you a few different pieces to the puzzle of a multifaceted attack that shocked the world and famously brought to life a sleeping giant, galvanizing a nation that would put 16 million Americans in uniform by the end of the war. One of those already in uniform and on the island for that fateful day was a young Native American from southeastern Arizona who had enlisted just 2 months earlier. Francisco Paredes was proud of his Mescalero Apache heritage and thankful to know a sailor from his hometown was on Oahu with him.
A friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him, and we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know, and I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu, because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times. But you're a 21-year-old kid. You're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
And you said you were helping out for 7 or 8 days in the aftermath of the Japanese attack. And there aren't a whole lot of people left with us anymore that actually saw those things with their own two eyes. What are some of the things that you saw and experienced in those days following the attack that you still remember today, that in when you close your eyes, you can still picture exactly what that looked like?
Well, to me, you know, I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you, to me, they make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. So when I went back to Pearl Harbor in 1990, I went to the memorial, and there was Japanese people going to the USS Arizona, and they were speaking in Japanese, and they were descendants of the pilots that had bombed Pearl Harbor, because, you know, I had a lot of Japanese friends here before the war. And I learned a little bit about Japanese, you know. I could understand some of it, but not all of it. But they had, you know, people there too, you know, wanted to go see the memorial. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming out. And I think that'll go on forever, because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know. Her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to grave registration, it took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
And I know you'd been exposed to a lot through working in the mines and doing your tuna trip to South America and all that. So you'd seen a lot and experienced a lot, but I can't imagine that being easy to see this death and destruction all around you. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with it at the time?
Well, you have to deal with whatever comes along. You have to deal with it, you know, one way or the other. Some people, as a rule, you know, deals like what I went through, they'd go bananas. But I kept my wits, you know, and I'm doing fine as of now, you know. And I'm still doing great.
What's the secret? How do you do that?
You would have to ask me that. I think it's my Indian heritage. As I was growing up, I did a lot of things what the Indians did. And to this day, I still do when I can, you know. Believe it or not, I do powwows at Table Mountain Casino here in California. Once in a while, I go to Window Rock, Arizona, because I had some original cult talkers in Window Rock, and they're all buried in Fort Defiance, Arizona. And I go there once in a while. You can't drink Corona there anymore.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
Frank would do that for the rest of the war, despite being wounded on three separate occasions. He's 96 now. He'll be 97 in February. And when I spoke with him this week, he was giving me his ideas for fundraising for Honor Flight, so more veterans could visit their memorials in Washington, D.C. the way he did. Quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors are going to be back on Oahu for the 75th anniversary, including some of the men we've heard from in recent weeks here on Hometown Heroes, and also 98-year-old Eugene Leonard, who will surely have some memories flooding back when he looks at the land near Barber's Point that once was home to Marine Corps Air Station Eva. That's where he was 75 years ago. Did you have any idea before December 7th? Was there any concern that the Japanese might attack?
None at all. Absolutely surprised.
Tell me about that Sunday morning. What's the first thing you remember?
I remember the airplanes flying about, 8-10 miles away. Coming in, they looked different, but they was tiny. You know, that's quite a ways away. And I could see torpedoes hanging halfway below the airplane. The nose would be pointed down from the airplane. That's what they used to sink the different ships.
So when you first saw the airplanes, did you think?
We discussed it. You know, all the guys, we stand college, you know, your mom. Yeah. But hey, what's going on? Hey, they look different. And as soon as that's over, of course, I had to go to my guard station. And when we went to the guard station, when we was attacked for this base, see, this is the first airplane come over our way, attacked the truck that I was in.
When you first saw those planes, did you think they were American planes?
Oh, no. I could see that red thing.
Even when they were far away, though, I mean, when you saw them on the horizon.
I didn't know what there was when they were far away. We didn't know what there was.
So did it start to trigger maybe something's wrong here?
No, I really didn't know something was wrong at all until we got in the ring and that plane come after us. Then I knew something was wrong. We knew right then, but it's already too late. We didn't have anything to do.
So you and another guard are driving a truck. How big a truck?
Just a pickup with a flatbed.
So you don't have much protection?
No protection whatsoever.
And the very first plane that comes in that's firing
at that truck. They was coming in from the north side of the island and across. And we could see them going across to Pearl Harbor. And you see, they just broke off. They had to get our airplanes too, you know.
Yeah.
And they broke off. Say there was Schofield Barracks and Wheeler Armor Air, all them. They was attacking them all at the same time.
And you guys at your field had, what, about 40 or 50 airplanes?
Well, there was three squadrons, and we only had about eight in our squadron. And then there's dive bombing, a fighter squadron, and another a scout bomber squadron.
And so some of those planes are planes that, had you guys been able to get them in the air, could have fought with the Japanese planes and inhibited the damage.
The rear gunners and all that would be after them, and the fighter planes and everything.
But they were able to destroy them all right there on the ground.
They destroyed them on the ground. No ammunition anywhere.
And they almost destroyed you. So your truck, the Japanese plane is firing machine gun bullets right at you. You got out of the truck. And
I got out of it, so did the other guy.
And you had an idea of where a safe place to go would be. Tell me what that was.
Well, that was the big building where the morning mask was, where the holes was in the ground.
So this Eva Field had been used in World War I with dirigibles, inflatable airships.
Right.
But you knew that in that building, as kind of a leftover of the old technology, there were these big holes
That's
in the ground.
Right. There's just holes in the ground.
How big around were they?
Oh, it wasn't round. It was long, probably that wide.
4 or 5 feet?
Yeah, 4 feet, 5 feet long.
So you and the other guy run in there and jump in those holes?
He didn't follow me. No. I just went for the, I don't know where he went.
So you just knew that's a safe place to go?
I was trying to get away from the bullets is all I knew.
So you hopped down in this hole. Was there anything else in that hole?
No.
Nothing crawling on you?
Like I say, scorpions was all over the place, and was and spiders and all that. So that's about all that's around.
So you preferred a bug bite to a Japanese bullet?
I knew the holes were there. See, I was second in rank. The number one sergeant in rank was killed probably 75 feet from where I was at. He got out there for... grabbed a fire extinguisher where the airplane was, and he got shot.
Were you guys pretty defenseless at that point?
We was defenseless.
You didn't have anti-aircraft guns or anything like that?
We didn't have anything, no ammunition or anything.
So the best thing you could have done is what you did, because there was nothing you were going to do to the Japanese. You just had to make sure you survived. What was it like to be in that hole? And what were you hearing? What was happening around you?
All I heard was the rattle of the building of the machine gun fire hitting it. I was trying to save myself. I didn't know what was going on except that I was being shot at.
When the building stopped rattling and you came out of there, what did you see? What was the scene around you?
Airplanes on fire. Just piles of planes are burning. All that fuel had to be burnt. See, it's burning everywhere.
So much of Oahu was burning that Sunday morning. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from a man who was flying an American bomber into that chaotic scene on December 7th, 1941. For photos and links to all of these complete interviews, visit hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to this special Veterans Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes. It is so heartening to see all the expressions of gratitude across the country for our men and women in uniform, and to see how that sentiment can be found in just about every corner of our culture, including the tip-off of college basketball season, and the University of Arizona wearing USS Arizona-themed jerseys for its opener against Michigan State in Honolulu. Honolulu is where global attention will be focused on December 7th for the 75th anniversary of a Sunday morning morning that changed the world. Again, I want to remind you, you can find links to Pearl Harbor-related episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. We've talked to people who were all over the island of Oahu that day, from Battleship Row to Hickam, Wheeler, Schofield Barracks, you name it. But one of the more interesting perspectives came from a man who would become a record-breaking pilot. He's 98 years old now, and he's still flying model airplanes competitively in Southern California. But on December 7th, 1941, he was approaching Honolulu after a long flight from Northern California. When he kissed his wife Betty Jo goodbye the night before, Robert Thacker had no idea what he'd be getting into.
We had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian. And I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, 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 noise. Come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, the tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, it's bang, 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 bang all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I chopped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line, and if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
Whew. I can't imagine the amount of things that go through your mind in a situation like that, when you know that your friends are dying, you don't know what's going to happen to you. How did you respond to the chaos?
Everything went out of those barracks. Everything went out of those hangars. There were motorcycles. There were people. There were engines. Everything was on fire. They wiped out that. They did a beautiful job with it. And 13 biddies, I think they were, at about 8,000. And they didn't miss. They really wiped out that flight land. And where are you going to go? What are you going to do? How can you help? How can you protect? First thing you do is protect your crew, which we left that out. And a little sort of side story. I took the crew down to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on Wednesday for lunch. It was all free. The Japs were going to take the islands. There's no question about it. We had no foxholes. We had no nothing. It's an unbelievable story. And the Japanese did such a perfect operation. Mass, surprise, all of the great elements of war, and they did it beautifully. There's no question about that. They sank every boat in that harbor. There were 3 feet of bunker fuel on fire in Pearl Harbor. They sank every boat in the harbor. They sank the floating dock, and they sank the boat in the floating dock. Quite an operation.
And I know, as someone with the military background that you have, you can appreciate the success of their operation, but I'm sure emotionally for you, being an American, wearing that uniform, and seeing that devastation had to have some kind of impact on you. What did it do to you in terms of your focus and desire to do anything?
You asked me where I grew up, and I said I grew up in the Air Force. That grew you up real quick. Real quick. But I think my attitude is just a little bit different, because the military was going to be my career. I made a judgment at that time. And the military is like any other, it's like General Motors or any other big corporation. And it was my job. It was my job. And I was lucky to survive.
And he'd go on to serve 31 years in the Air Force before retiring as a colonel. So many things he was fortunate to survive, but especially that morning of December 7th. And as he described ending up at Hickam Field that day, it made me think of the folks we've heard from on Hometown Heroes who were at that Army Air Corps base that morning. Leon Webster had grown up in Oklahoma and Arkansas, volunteered to serve in 1939, and had gotten to Hickam Field before the barracks were even up, when it was just a tent city. Here's how he remembered December 7th, 1941.
I was adjacent to our barracks wing at Hickam Field, which was a new constructed barracks there. And I looked up from the street adjacent to my wing, and a Japanese fighter pilot was diving directly at me, standing in the street. And I could see the old concrete street ripping up in front of me before I dove to the right, as my friend Don Thompson says, get the hell out of the street, and just missed being killed for the first time in my life, thank God.
The first time, and when you say the first, it kind of sounds like it might not be the last. How close would you say those strafing bullets from that Japanese plane came to you?
It was close enough so that I now can close my eyes. The pilot was diving on the street I was standing in, adjacent to my barracks wing at Hickam Field. It's a wing, by the way, that you can still go to and place your fingers and hands into some large bomb-shredded parts that were cut out of the wing when they attack us on December 7th.
So this strafing is ripping up the street in front of you, and you could feel the concrete on your neck?
I absolutely could, yet. I can just close my eyes and remember that day, the only day that I knew for a fact that I was trying to be killed. I have never had an experience like it, and of course, being that type of experience is one that I'll never forget. I can almost feel the concrete chips as they hit the left cheek of my face as he cut up the street, diving with his machine guns going.
And I've talked to a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors, and most of them expressed that confusion initially, thinking that this was some kind of maneuver, that these were American airplanes. Sounds like you didn't have much doubt in your mind.
Not at that time, but earlier we all thought it was a mock attack by the Navy, or from Wheeler Field, which was a fighter base, and because we had had mock attacks from those places previously, and that was our first thought. But after the bullets started hitting nearby, we realized it was the real thing. And then we looked up and could see the large red circle on the bottoms of the wings of the attacking aircraft. And then we were sure it was Japanese planes.
So you're ducking for cover from this plane. And then I imagine you had to be experiencing some kind of fear, concern, doubt, anxiety. How would you describe what happened after that and what you were able to do?
I was able to dive to my right from the street over to a building that was built about for the reason they were building, making those temporary buildings for supply that was directly across the street from the wing of my barracks, about 2 feet off the ground because of the humidity in Hawaii. And I got back under that where a friend of mine, Don Thompson, was already there and yelling for me to get the hell out of the street.
So you guys took cover in that little 2-foot separation from the ground to the base of these buildings?
That's right. That's correct. And those buildings were all built about 2 feet off the ground due to the humidity in those days in Hawaii.
How long would you say that you stayed huddled under there?
There was two attacks, and we got out after the first attack just momentarily, and due to the commotion and the people yelling, they're coming back, we ran back and got under the same building we were under previously, which saved us, and it was the most natural place to go when the second attack occurred.
When you were in a situation like that, really not in control, just praying that nothing hits that building that's going to blow it up or goes through it and gets you, what do you do? Are you clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? Are you talking to each other? What are you doing?
As a matter of fact, I've thought about the moments that attack happened, and I can't describe it because I know I was in total shock. I'd never been in such a situation. And what I did was just something you do automatically, and it never gave much thought to it. It was something you just do.
What did you see when it was finally safe to crawl out from under there?
Actually, we saw a lot of guys that had been hit by the strafing aircraft and was lying, and someone confiscated an old truck there on the base at Hickam Field. And my friend of mine, Donald Thompson, and I was helping pick up people that were wounded and was dead and putting them in groups and helping load them onto this truck to be taken up to Fort Shafter, which was our headquarters building. And then later they wound up in the cemetery up there in the old vacant volcano.
The Punch Bowl.
Punch Bowl Cemetery, yes.
And I have to guess, now I know that you lost your father when you were just 8 years old, and dealing with that kind of tragedy is tough, but I have to imagine you had never witnessed anything like these wounded men and dead bodies that you were trying to pack up and get out of there.
Never before in my imagination, and actually never since. It's the most frightening day I can think of that happened to me in my lifetime. But on the other hand, it's the most thankful day that I survived it, because all around me were friends of mine. And actually, in my one squadron at Hickam Field at the time, where there were many, many different squadrons, we lost 8 personal friends of mine from my one squadron.
How hard was that? Did you look at them and say, that could have been me? How did you deal with that?
I think I was in such shock, I don't believe I could describe that to you, although I'd like to. You just can't believe what's happened when those things happen and you see dead bodies lying all around outside the barracks in those days, and you help load them onto trucks to be carried away. You're in such shock that it'd be hard to describe.
When did you realize, you've gotten this personal glimpse of it, you've seen your friends killed, but when did you grasp the entire scope of what had happened there and the significance of the lives lost and the blow that Japan had landed on America that day?
It wasn't soon. It actually happened at least a day later, after we spent most of the night not sleeping at all, and after we'd visited certain places on the base and helped load people that were wounded and dead, and went down to our barracks to see many of our aircraft destroyed and the fires that were still burning down at the flight line in those days, and just the shock of it all. I don't think the first night after the raid I slept at all. So it might have been the second or third night before I actually got any sleep to amount to anything.
And when you did see all of that, you saw how your installation there at Hickam had been decimated, and then you realized the losses that the Navy had absorbed out in Pearl Harbor. What kind of emotions did it stir up in you? Did you feel anger? Did you feel despair, a desire for revenge or payback? What do you remember feeling?
Well, pretty much all of the same. We, at that time, had no respect for the people that attacked us from Japan. We called them Japs. We called it a Jap raid. Later in life, I became very good friends with the Japanese people because my company established a base in Japan, and I traveled with them for a number of years and spent quite a bit of time in Japan and learned to like the people very much.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, Battleship Row, where the most damage was done, and the story of a man who survived 34 hours trapped in his capsized battleship, only to learn that his brother did not make it out alive. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating all of those who have served on this Veterans Day weekend and hoping that that won't be limited to this weekend. The 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor is coming up on December 7th. All five living survivors of the USS Arizona will be there on Oahu to honor their shipmates, so many of whom remain entombed aboard that sunken vessel. Did you know that 23 sets of brothers died aboard the Arizona? Just imagine what those families went through. And after the 1,177 who died on the Arizona, more men perished on the battleship USS Oklahoma than any other ship there, 429 of them. The next voice you're going to hear is Richard Swede Artley, who served aboard the Oklahoma with his brother, Daryl.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma and very likely 10.
How did you experience that? Where were you? And
I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees. Just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were. As those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, was a heavyweight wrestler. Mm-hmm. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells, I don't know why, I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose or broke loose. There was a line there, oh God, I don't know how long it was, of guys on gurneys waiting to go in the hospital to get an operation. And I kept thinking, well, when they get down to the door to put me in there, I'll just tell them no again. And I couldn't say a word. And they gave me a spinal injection. Doctor, every time he'd find a bone, he'd come around that little screen head in front of me and tell me I've got another one, you know. And he did a pretty good job.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war, and you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, I slept some of the time down there. And the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment was completely full of water? He said, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had two seamen on there that had gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. Somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anyway. We know where you are and we're coming as fast as we can. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there's a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
So I want to get this right. So you would have been down there about 34 hours. If this didn't, you weren't out of there until 6 o'clock Monday night. You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done.
Did it help to have so many others in the room? You think it would have been harder if it was one or two guys, but since you had?
I think that we all pretty good friends, and we all talked to each other down there.
You said you slept for some of the time. 34 hours is a long time. I'm sure a lot of things went through your mind. Were you wondering where your brother might be?
Well, I knew where he was. He was in CIC, that's Combat Information Center. That's right amidships. I was almost sure in my own mind that some of those torpedoes got that CIC.
And I want to talk about your brother more, but I'm really interested in how you survived those 34 hours and kept your wits about you. Was there anything that someone said or anything that was happening down there that you think buoyed your guys' spirits or made you believe that you could and would be rescued?
We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. When a disaster happens on a ship, the first lieutenant takes over. The captain doesn't have a thing to say. And he kept talking to us. And we got down where we could talk to him verbally. We got our spirits up then. We thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. And by golly, they did.
You're just 19 years old at the time. Were you too young and dumb to be scared?
Oh, I was scared. Oh, yeah. And you know, I'll tell you something very odd, and I think this is the truth. Of the 34 that they got out of that ship by just drilling these holes and getting them out through escape ways that way, I'm the last one that's still alive.
There are other survivors of the ship, but not other survivors of the guys who were trapped.
Yeah, the 429 were killed, but there were only 34 that were trapped where they had no way of getting out. I can't understand why we were so lucky.
And I'm sure after you got out of there, and 34 hours probably seemed like 34 days in some respects, but after you got out of there, you must have been awfully grateful to the guys who got you out. Did you have a chance to find them, to thank them, to figure out their story?
No, tell you the truth, I didn't. Not even one of them.
If you had, what do you think you would have said?
I would have, if I had a brain in my head, I'd at least said thank you.
Well, you probably had plenty on your mind at that point, because
they got us out. They only got two more out. They were up forward, way up forward, but they didn't get it in time. That was the last two they got out.
I would have to imagine, I'm making an assumption here. I would imagine that in all the years since, that any time you see one of these catastrophes and they're searching for survivors, you probably want them to keep on going, huh?
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
When you see that, when you see Oklahoma City or 9/11 and these situations where the odds are long to find any survivors and they keep searching and they find someone, does that bring it all back to you? Is it like living your experience all over again?
In some ways, it does. Makes me that much more thankful that they didn't give up on us.
From what I understand, you guys weren't just sitting around down there during all of this. There were a lot of things you tried to do to keep the water out.
That fresh air blower, we took a mattress off. They were only about 30 inches in diameter. And we rolled that up and stuffed it in there. It was a hell of a job doing it, too, because the water was coming in there pretty hard. Then we got clothes and skivvies and everything like that. We just damn near stopped that water coming in.
And that probably saved your life.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of many things that saved your life that day, and there are all kinds of reasons since then to be thankful for that. But I'm curious what the aftermath of it was for you, because you've just been through this ordeal that very few people in the history of the world can understand what it's like to be in. Did it take a while for it to sink into you what you'd been through, and how did you cope with it in the aftermath?
Well, I really can't answer that question. Jim Bounds, that guy was, they took the Helen and had taken two or three torpedoes. They had taken her there to the Navy Yard to have her fixed up. And the first night we got in there, Jim says, "Let's go ashore, Artie." "No, I go ashore tonight, not tonight." "Well, by gosh," she says, "I am." So I said, "Well, go ahead." And the next morning I was going to breakfast. He says, "Hey, sweetie, what do you think happened last night?" I said, "God, man, I couldn't, somebody from Mississippi, I couldn't guess what they did." "What'd you do?" He says, "I got married." "You knew her a long time, huh?" "Yeah, a few hours," he said. "And you know, when they had that, we got the memorial for the Oklahoma finally was finished and up. My wife said to me, she said, "You get yourself on a plane and get over there." So I did. And who do you think I ran into first that I knew real well? Jim Bounds and his wife, Ruby. The one he married in, over there in San Francisco that first night he went ashore.
I guess it was a pretty wise decision he made after all.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Back in 1941, in the aftermath of the Oklahoma sinking, and obviously you get off of it, and you're rescued, and you start to realize, wow, our ship wasn't the only one. And in terms of the history, the Oklahoma losing 429 men that day was second only to the Arizona, which had close to 1,200 killed on December 7th. How did you swallow all of that? And when did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Daryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Daryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later. He was a terrific pitcher.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted. They had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time. And Francis and Jack.
Your boyhood friends.
Daryl and those two friends, we'd known them all our lives. Now they're all dead.
And Mr. Artley is gone now, too. He passed away shortly after that conversation was recorded in 2011. His story is one I know I'll never forget. And that's the message every Pearl Harbor survivor I've ever met has echoed. Never forget. Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. We're out of time, but thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes. Make sure to take time and say thank you to all the veterans in your life. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll remember on Veterans Day and every day that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.